going to start off today a little quicker than usual. I've got the quizzes back. The average on the quiz was a 17 out of 20. There might be a problem or two I can go over later, but I'm a little early to go over it right now. The lowest was a 12. I can remember one quiz that the average was a 12. So, generally speaking, okay on the quiz. Okay, you'll see your averages so far include all the bonus work. Some of you got your bonuses back on Friday in the labs, and some of you got it back today. Okay, again, the idea of the bonuses, Andy. The idea of the bonuses is precisely that. Bonus allows you to explore topics that have happened since the turn of the last century, the previous century before the one you were born, that is. And there is not a total that you are getting. Not getting so many points out of 10, you're getting points. All right, they're relative points. Okay, and if I were to grade them on what you did wrong, you probably wouldn't have gotten as many points as you did get. Right. My wife looked at a couple of the papers, kind of surprised at the English. Okay, I did not correct any of the English. Okay, otherwise I would be spending all week correcting them. Okay. Suggesting how to rewrite them. You should pay attention to that no matter what you write, whether you're just writing a bonus for me or writing something for the English department. Alright, at some point, your communication skills are going to be important when you get out of here, and unfortunately, it's going to maybe just reflect on the university in some cases. Okay, so you want to improve your skills at writing. Okay. I expect any time you write something like that, it doesn't matter if it's for me or anyone else, if it's not your idea, you should always reference it. Alright, so there always should be a bibliography. People ask me, should I include a bibliography? The obvious answer is yes. No matter what you do. Unless you're bringing this stuff out of the blue on your own, which in these cases, obviously, you can't. Okay. So, you need to reference things. Okay. So those are a few comments about the bonuses. Okay, I need to see sufficient effort relative to other people. Okay. As it is, the average on the bonus was 5 points, which is quite a bit of points on average. Alright, so everybody should be happy even if you got 3 points. Okay. So, enough said about that. You have an average grade. I'm not putting the averages up today. It's probably not important at this point. But the average in the class at this point is an 80. Okay. And we want to keep that. All right. We just come back from a nice rest. Because I don't know how many of you. I know at least one person in the class has done some physics over the weekend because I got my email. Okay, we have a quiz tomorrow, so we need to get back on track, and we've got 2 more weeks. We want to keep going no matter how hot it gets. Okay, and keep our fingers crossed that there are no hurricanes that will interrupt. Well, I've only had one hurricane interrupt my summer school class, and that was the second session. And that was back in 96, I believe. And Fran came in. Well, Fran came in at September, 7 weeks later. So, Bertha came through first. Okay, that was the earliest hurricane that we actually had to cancel summer school for. So, first session's never been canceled, so I'm expecting it. You never know. Okay, so let's go back to Chapter 7 and then finish up Chapter 7. Chapter 7 is on impulse and momentum. We begin, first off, with impulse. Okay, I apply an average force during a certain period of time, actually an average net force, to an object, and see the response. So the average force times the time that it's in contact with the object is the impulse, designated by J. B is the momentum. The momentum of an object, the linear momentum in this case, the mass times the velocity, mv. By now we should know that momentum is mv. We did this, used it to lab. So the impulse momentum theorem is the relationship between the impulse and the momentum. The impulse is equal to the change in momentum. The impulse is what you deliver. The momentum is the change in momentum is the response. So J is equal to delta P. And then we spent some time the other day computing the change in momentum for different types of cases. Okay? Then at the end of the class, I looked at what happens when two objects collide. We have two objects coming together. One exerts a force on the second. The second one exerts a force back on the first. Those forces are the internal forces, and due to Newton's third law, they cancel. If I have many bodies, you have the same kinds of things where the different masses can interact with each other, but they may be exposed to some external forces like gravity, in which case those do not cancel in general. So what we have, okay, is for a system of masses, we could just label them m1, m2, m3, etc. Each of them moving at some velocity. Notice this is a velocity vector, so this could be in three dimensions. Okay, where direction is a little harder to deal with. Now I can compute the momentum for each body, the mass times the velocity for every single mass in the system. The total momentum of the system you get by adding up all the momenta. Momenta is the plural of momentum. There's no such thing as momentums. Okay? Latin. So, you add up the momenta for the whole system. That is called the total linear momentum of the system. Okay? So far all we know is linear momentum. Okay? By sometime later this week we'll know that there's other momentum. Okay, so add up all of these for every body. Okay, so sigma again is a sum. Each I is an index that labels the body, so this is I equals 1 to the number of bodies that I have. Let's say N is the number of bodies, so that's the total momentum. In the case that I was doing at the end of the class the other day in the derivation, now I had two bodies. And then I used the impulse momentum theorem to show that since the internal forces add up to 0, that just leaves left the sum of the forces. Sum of the forces external to the system times left up delta T. Delta T, that's the impulse, total impulse to the system, is equal to the change in the total momentum. So that's delta T. So the impulse momentum theorem, at least for two particles, we got this. Okay. Or, this tells me that the sum of the external forces, another way to write this, is just the change in the total momentum of the system divided by the elapsed time. So that's another form that this could be written. Conservation of linear momentum results from the following statement. If the net external force acting on a system is 0, So if the net external force is zero, that tells me the change in total momentum is what? Zero. That is the conservation of linear momentum. Or the total momentum of the system is a constant. Does that look familiar? All right, we had that the change in mechanical energy was zero for conservative systems. Okay, when there were no frictional losses, etc., which meant that the energy, the total mechanical energy, was constant at all times. It means anytime I looked at a system, that energy was constant. In this case, anytime I look at my system of interacting particles, all right, if the net external force is zero, then the total linear momentum is the same at all times. Now, this is a little difficult to do when you're in several dimensions. Sometimes we are restricted by, say, motion in a line. As we saw in Chapter 2, we restricted ourselves to motion in a line. So it's not hard to believe that I can restrict myself to motion in a line. And so we could write this in a one-dimensional form, which is much easier to handle. And that's what we're going to do, is look at collisions like we did in the lab for one-dimensional motion, which is a little easier than looking at collision for two-dimensional motion. Okay, so it is doable. And we'll be satisfied for just doing things in 1D. Okay. So this is my state for conservation of linear momentum. That's one of the main results of this chapter. Big principle, along with conservation of mechanical energy. What we need to do is look at consequences of this conservation principle and look at various applications so we can see how it applies. We've already seen one in the lab, but we'll come back to that in a few minutes. Okay? So let's start off with a nice system. Again, like I said, we're going to restrict a lot of what we're doing to one-dimensional motion, and in fact, most of the time we're going to restrict it to two objects. We're not going to throw 10 bodies at you and ask you to see what happens necessarily. Okay. So, simple example. Let's say you have a boy, a wagon, and a ball. Let's say we have no friction. Well, doesn't matter. Okay, we have no external forces acting on the system, so we don't want friction acting on the system. Right? We want the net to be zero. We want gravity is acting on the system this way. But as I said, one-dimensional motion is going to be horizontal. There is no gravitational force component that's horizontal, right? Not unless I went and put this on an incline. And we're not going to do that. Okay? So, not right now. All right, so let's say I have has a ball. Okay? Cart's still, the kid's still, nothing is moving. That is my system. So in this case, my system consists of the kid and the cart and a ball. Okay? Now, what I would like to do is ask what happens when the kid throws the ball out the wagon. Okay? So let's see. Let's say that the ball is, I don't know, 5 kilograms. Say the kid plus the wagon would be, I don't give me a number. 100. Alright, so the kid plus the wagon is 100. Alright, the kid throws the ball out off the wagon. So let's say that the ball leaves at 2.5 meters per second with respect to the ground. What's going to happen in general? Of course, I could have had the kid jump out the wagon. If the kid jumped out the wagon, what would happen? You ever try to jump out of a wagon? Fall on your face? Yeah? Don't remember. Huh?
It will be after you throw the ball.
It will be after you throw the ball, as Matt just said. That's the point. So, kid jumps out the wagon, right? He jumps out the wagon, flies off. Alright? But you don't have to have the kid jump out. The point is you have the ball fly out. So the kid throws the ball, the wagon's going to move. Okay? That's the whole point. In any of these problems, as we've already started to see, we're going to have to look at what happens before and after. So this is my before picture. The kid's sitting there with the ball, not moving. You can't do that for very long because the kid's not sitting still for very long. Okay? And then I need an after picture. So let's see, what would the after look like? Wagon. And we have ball. The ball is going to be going at some velocity. Let's call the ball mass 2. Called the kid plus the wagon mass 1. The ball is going to move with velocity of 2.5 meters per second. And the question is, how fast does the kid plus the wagon move? Okay. So this is basically, we can consider the kid plus the wagon as one mass. Okay. So, that's the picture. Of course, we're going to reduce this to blocks, right? We don't have to get this fancy a drawing, right? Got one mass going that way, one mass going that way afterwards. Okay. Assuming that the net external force is zero in the horizontal direction, we have that the total momentum is a constant. So we look at the total momentum initially, put a sub I here for initial, not to be confused with my general sum. And let that be equal to the final momentum. So whatever the total momentum is here before should be equal to the total momentum afterwards, providing there are no external forces acting in a horizontal direction, which means I have to rule out any frictional force. Alright, so what are we doing here? Okay, how do I compute the total momentum before? Over here. How do I do that? Okay, you take a look at each mass, multiply it times its velocity, and add them up. What is the mass, the velocity of the kid plus wagon before? Zero. So what's the momentum of the kid plus wagon? Zero before. What about the ball? Zero. So initially, nothing's moving. Okay, let's look at kid plus the ball here. The mass of the kid, we'll call that M1, times the velocity of the kid, I'll call that V1. Kid plus wagon. We don't know the velocity of the kid. And we know the kid's going to go that way, but we're going to indicate V1 in that direction. That's positive. Right? So if V1 comes out negative, as we would expect, then that just indicates the kid is actually moving to the left. Okay? That's the momentum of the kid plus wagon. After, the momentum of the ball is M2. The velocity of the ball is V2 afterwards. Did I say momentum? Okay. So, MV is the momentum of the ball afterwards. The total momentum afterwards, you add these two up. That's the point. All right? So here's the total momentum after, the total momentum before. Okay, if linear momentum is conserved, these must be equal. Okay. Okay. So it's not really a difficult problem. It's just a first time to know. Okay. So what do we know? Let's plug in what we know. 0 is M1. That's the kid plus the wagon. That's 100 V1. Plus M2. That's the ball, times how fast is the ball, 2.5. Okay? The idea here is that we just have one equation, one unknown, so we can solve that for V1. V1 is equal to, bring that 5 times 2.5 to the other side, negative, divide by 100. All right? Well, algebra. And see what we get. 5 times 2.5 is what? 5 divided by 100. Negative. 0.125 or 1.3 meters per second. Okay. So, we notice that the wagon plus the kid move. They don't move very fast. Right? Because it's much, you know, the wagon plus the kid is more massive by a lot compared to this. Okay? So, there's one example.
So
okay,
even though
we can use conservation.
Even though we wrote the vector for V1 going to the right, the answer still needs to be negative.
Well, I always indicate that direction is positive. So when the answer comes out negative, that definitely means the kid's moving to the left, right?
Right. So, okay. But if we had to draw the vector after we figured out what the actual velocity was, we'd have to draw it to the left, right?
Yeah, if you had to draw the vector afterwards, you can indicate, yes, it's moving to the left, because it is. But labeling, we always label the positive direction, work through, and then when the negative comes out, we know it's negative. When the positive came out, we know it's in our positive direction. Okay. So intuitively, we should know that negative is what we expect. If we don't get a negative, we would be worried, right? That maybe we made a mistake or something. Okay. Everybody all right with that? Okay, so that's one example. There's all kinds of examples we can come up with. Instead of having the two masses going away from each other, we can have one of the masses coming to it. So, for example, what if a kid's sitting in a cart and somebody throws the ball to the kid? All right, then they come together. Okay, the ball has initial momentum. Then you want to know what is the momentum afterwards so you can find out how fast the ball plus the kid are moving. All right, so you can do different types of scenarios. Another kind of problem, let's do one where both masses are moving initially. So let's consider two box cars. mass is 6 times 10 to the third kilograms, and so let the first one be M1, let the second one be M2, and let's assume that M1 is moving faster than M2, otherwise we won't catch up to it. So let's see, let's say that M1 is moving at 1.5 meters per second, trying to catch up to M2, which is probably about, let's say, a half meter per second. Wants to come up, right? They want to link together, right? Dock or whatever our terminology is. Okay. So before, this is the situation. Then they're going to link up together, and then the question is, how fast are they moving afterwards? So again, this would be four pictures. Okay. Mass 1 catches up to mass 2. They connect together. It's very similar to what you did in lab the other day, except your mass 2 wasn't moving at all. Okay. So there's mass 1 connects to mass 2. And these have an overall final velocity, which we don't know. That's the afterwards. And given this information, the question is, what's the final velocity of these two cars? Okay. Again, it's pretty much the same as the last problem, except we just have to sit down. A little bit more work. Anyway, we have mass 1, mass 2. Let's call the, we can label these anything we want for the time being. I could put all kinds of fancy subscripts like the initial velocity of mass 1 and the initial velocity of mass 2. Okay, but in a situation like this, I can do some kind of labeling which could limit how many subscripts I need, so it's not quite as ugly looking. So here's the velocity of mass 1 before, velocity of mass 2 before. They stick together. There's a common final velocity, so that's enough labeling. Okay? All right. Assuming that the net external force is 0 in the horizontal direction, then we need to write down again the initial total linear momentum, final total linear momentum. Those should be equal. Let me write it out symbolically. So let's see. The total momentum of mass 1 is?
M1V1.
The total momentum of mass 2 before is? M2V2. So the total momentum before, the initial total momentum, is just the sum of those two momenta. Alright, this one plus that. Then you look afterwards. You look at all your masses and you add up the total momentum of each of those. So what is the momentum of mass 1 afterwards?
M1VF.
What's the total momentum of mass 2 afterwards? M2. So that's the total. Note we could actually rewrite the right side of this equation by factoring out the common VF, and I'd end up with M1 plus M2 VF. Now, we could have gotten this by noticing that afterwards, this really looks like a one mass of mass M1 plus M2 moving at velocity V. All right? So we could have just written this down right away. Either one of these works. It's just a matter of how you look at the problem. Okay, though computationally this one's easier. And sooner or later you're going to have to factor. But, you know, either way it doesn't matter. Okay, now I need to put some numbers in. What am I looking for? Well, I'm looking for VF. So let me divide VF, what's in front of the VF into both sides. So algebraically I can get VF is M1 V1 plus M2 V2 divided by the sum of the masses. And there's the final velocity. It's just now a matter of plugging all the numbers in. All right, what was mass 1? 6 × 10³ times velocity. Mass 1 was 1.5 initially, plus 9 × 10³ times the velocity, which is 5, divided by the sum of the masses, which is 1.5 plus 5. Denominator is 2. That's easy. 1.5 times 6 is 9 plus 4.5. What? Sorry about that. We're not adding the velocities on the bottom. We're adding the masses. Numbers not thinking about what I was doing. Okay. There. All right. So now we have 9 plus 13.5 over 15.
0.9.
Notice that I've got a 10³ that I can factor out of the top, 10³ I can factor out of there, so that all goes away. So I'm going to get just 0.9?
Mm-hmm.
0.9 what?
Meters per second.
But what is it? Not 0.90, 0.9.
Just 0.9.
Just 0.9. Alright? Everybody agrees that's just 0.9? Alright, does that make sense? Let's see. 0.9 is certainly less than this mass, so when this comes here, alright, the second mass is going to be going a little faster, the first mass is going to slower. So that makes sense. Is it in the right direction? Mm-hmm. Right? Positive, so it's moving to the right as expected, right? So those kinds of things you can answer without having had physics. It's just a matter of the magnitude, right? Okay. So in these cases, we're really doing collision problems. Some extent. Here, this is a collision problem. This mass hits that mass, and they take off. These connect together, okay, and then take off. So we're beginning to see collisions. Over here, this is sort of a collision problem. Okay, if you took a film of this and ran the film backwards, then it would look like a collision, wouldn't it? The ball colliding with the kid plus wagon. So that is sort of a backwards version of collision problem. All right, we'd like to do some more collision problems. In which case, we make use of conservation of linear momentum. Look at collisions in 1D. some statements I make can apply to all kinds of collisions. As we saw in the lab, there are two types of collisions. We have elastic collisions as the first type. In case of elastic collisions, we have conservation of mechanical energy. In all these cases with collisions, we are going to consider that the net external force is zero, so we will also have conservation of linear momentum. So if the net external force is not zero, at least we can write down that the change in the total momentum is equal to the net external force, and we can still do collision problems. It's just that life is easier when we don't have to deal with external forces. Okay, life's also easy when we don't have energy loss. Okay? So, elastic collisions, we have conservation of mechanical energy. We can add that to our conservation of linear momentum, which we saw we could use in these problems. Second type, inelastic collision. In this case, mechanical energy is not conserved. Have this part coming at instead of 1.5 meters per second, say 40 meters per second, which we know is close to 90 miles an hour. And what would happen in that case? We have a train wreck, right? And so, right, a lot of energy loss, a lot of smashed up cars and whatnot. Okay? So, mechanical energy would not be conserved. This is what we would define for inelastic collisions. Again, we're going to assume that the net external force is zero, so we will also have conservation of linear. So then any collision process in this chapter, we will assume that the net external force is zero, which means we will always have conservation of linear momentum. It's just that we do not always have conservation of mechanical energy. So, typical collisions. Let's see, two-body collision. One dimension. Okay, again, we're going to have a before picture and an after picture. Okay, as far as it is, we have two bodies, one coming along, hits another one, and that one goes off, and maybe they both go off. Okay, one does not go through the other, so we will still assume that one mass doesn't go through the other one. They can't occupy the same space at the same time. Okay. So that's the type of thing we're interested in. Let's say I have mass 1. Here's mass 2. Beforehand, we generally could have mass 1 moving along at some
initial velocity, so we can write the velocity of mass 1, V1, and indicate that it's the initial. We will write a sub I for initial. And then the velocity of mass 2 we could write as V2 sub I, because it also could be moving in general. Okay, but for our purposes, like we did in the lab, we're going to assume that V2i is 0, which means what? It's at rest. There's nothing wrong with me throwing in that mass 2 to be moving as well, or they could be coming together. Okay, but just for simplification, we'll just look at this case. So, there are two masses. One's going to collide with the other. Afterwards, what can happen in general is both masses can take off. So after mass 1 hits mass 2, we would have mass 1 is moving and mass 2 is moving. Again, not interchanging their order as I go from left to right. Mass 1 doesn't get ahead of mass 2. Mass 1 has a velocity V1 afterwards, or final. And mass 2 has velocity V2, so that for its final velocity. All right, so there's my collision. Mass 1 collides with mass 2, and they go off after together. So, for elastic collisions, what do? We write down what we know. We know that we have conservation of linear momentum. So we look at the before, and we say, what is the total initial momentum? What is the momentum of mass 1? It was M1 V1i. What is the total momentum of mass 2? Initially? 0. Right? So mass 2 times 0. So the total momentum before is M1V1i. The total momentum afterwards, M1V1f is the momentum of mass 1. M2V2f is the momentum of mass 2. Multiply those together and add them. So M1, V1f plus M2 V2F. So there's the total momentum afterwards. This is the conservation of linear momentum. If I did not have the conservation of mechanical energy, then this is all I know, and this would be the equation for inelastic collisions, which is the equation for two unknowns, I put in yellow. So we have two unknowns in this, and one equation and two unknowns is not very good. Okay? So for inelastic collisions, we're going to confine to objects sticking just like we did in the lab. What happens when two objects stick together at the end of this collision, for example, then V1F and V2F are the same, right? If mass 1 and mass 2 are stuck together, that means they're going to have the same final velocity. Okay? Come back to the example with the train car. This is a collision, one with another one. One's moving, not at rest like this, the one in the example that I'm doing now, but they come together, they stick together. right? That's a total inelastic collision. When these come together, they stick together. Energy is not conserved in that particular example. Okay? In fact, you can compute that. If you do a homework problem, compute the total energy before and the total energy after for that particular system, and convince yourself that you get two different numbers. Okay? So, all right. So, besides sticking together, like I said, in the example, the kid flushed the ball, they were together to begin with, and they come apart. All right? So, there's no conservation of energy in that problem either, right? Because, guess what? You had zero total energy to begin with, right? Afterwards, you don't. All right? So, all right. So, for this two-body collision, for elastic collisions, I would like to make use of the conservation of mechanical energy. Conservation of mechanical energy. Okay, if the mechanical energy is conserved, that means that the total energy, capital E, is a constant. What is the total mechanical energy in general that we know so far? It's the kinetic energy plus the potential energy equals a constant. Right? What is potential energy? Quick review. Stored energy. Right? In general. The only potential energy we know is gravitational potential energy, right? So what we know so far is that this looks like 1/2 mv squared plus mgh is a constant. In our two-body collision in one dimension, right, it's flat, right? I can't bring gravity into this problem because then I would have an external force acting on my system and I wouldn't have been able to use my conservation of linear momentum. So these objects are traveling horizontally. They're all at the same height. So if I pick H to be zero, my potential energy would be what?
Zero.
So I could set this up so that is zero. The only mechanical energy in my problem right now is kinetic energy. Okay. So when I come over here and look at the total energy before and the total after, all I have to do is add up kinetic energies. All right, so let's see. What is the energy of mass 1 before? Kinetic energy is 1/2 the mass, in this case m1, the velocity v1i squared. So everybody agrees that's the total kinetic energy before. If mass 2 were moving, right, I can now add its as well. So you see we can actually write down all the stuff we need for a little more general case where this is not zero. Alright, let's see. But kinetic energy of mass 2 initially is zero. Everybody agrees? The answer is yes. Okay. So now we go over here and put in the total kinetic energy of mass 1, total energy of mass 2 after the collision, and I end up with 1/2 m1 v1f squared plus 1/2 m2 V2F. Okay, so all the physics for the elastic collision are given by those three equations. And we assume that we know the initial masses and the initial velocity. Then the question is, what's the final velocity? So we want to make a prediction over here, we want to find V1F, V2F, given mass 1, mass 2, and the initial velocity of mass 1. And that's what we want to know. Well, there it is. We have two equations and two unknowns. We can algebraically solve these. All right? Feel free to do so. I'm not going to do it in front of you. Usually when I do this in class, they look more bored than they look now. Okay? But the idea, as I mentioned in the lab the other day, is relatively easy. Solve this equation for one of your unknowns. Plug it in here. You get one equation and one unknown, and it is solvable. So we can get our solutions. For the final velocities, V1F and V2F are gotten as multiples of the initial velocity of mass 1. This involves ratios using the masses, the denominator is m1 plus m2 in both cases, and the numerator is m1 minus m2 in the first, and 2m1 in the second. Where do these come from? Doing the algebra. Okay, so we can algebraically solve these. Let's see what happens.
Is that m1 minus m2 m1?
Yes. As I indicated in the lab, if I had two masses here that were the same, then M1 equal M2 would make V1F equal 0. And V2F was equal to what? M2, what do we get?
1.
You get 2M1 over M1 plus M1. You get 1 times V1I. So we get V2F to be V1I. So in this case, as I mentioned, right, many times in the lab the other day, if you have two pool balls and you hit one into the other one and they're hopefully the same mass and you're pretty good at it, get the one to stop, the other one to take off with all the energy that the initial one had. Okay, so that's what this corresponds to. Right? V1F, mass 1 stops. Okay, as an example. Okay, let's put a couple of other types of numbers in. Yes? V1I. Okay, so you just put M1 equal M2 here, this becomes 1, so V1I is equal to V2F. All right, let's just pick up some numbers. Let's say mass 1 is 1 kilogram. Let's say that mass 2 is, say, 2 kilograms. And the velocity initially of mass 1 is 3 meters per second. So let's say mass 1 hits mass 2 at 3 meters per second. Mass 1 is lighter than mass 2. Okay. So let's see what we get for the final velocity. So after the collision, the velocity of mass 1 is M1 minus M2 over the sum of the masses times the initial velocity of mass 1. What's the difference in the, what's M1 minus M2? Negative 1. What's M1 plus M2? 1 plus 2 is 3. And multiply that times 3 meters per second. You'll notice that the masses, in this ratio, we have mass over mass, right? So we're going to have kilograms over kilograms, grams over grams. That's unitless, right? So that's going to multiply something. That's a velocity in order to get a velocity out. Right? So all the units work out. Different things to think about when you have to remember this. Okay, let's see. The 3's go out, so we get minus 1 meter per second. So mass 1 comes in, runs into mass 2. Okay, just like in a football game, a little guy runs into a big guy and bounces off. All right? What is the velocity, the final velocity of mass 2? It's 2m1 over m1 plus m2. Do we expect the second mass to be moving faster or slower? Even without looking at this stuff. We have some faster, a couple of slower. Okay, let's see. All right, let's plug it in. Mass, what was mass 1? 1. Mass 1 plus mass 2. Again, 3. And V1I. 3. Go out. We just talked about three go out. I didn't think about that when I made this up. 2 times 1 is 2 meters per second. Good. Is that right? Okay, so initially we have, well, the answer was faster because mass 2 wasn't moving at all. Right? So it couldn't have gone slower than the rest. Okay. So when mass 1 collides with mass 2 takes off with some of that energy, 2 meters per second. Okay. So we could have done this problem like that, or I could have just gone and plugged all the numbers in and solved these two equations, right? Put all the numbers in there for the unknowns, right? Again, it's just two equations for the unknowns. Based on simple physical principles.
That makes sense that if something's flying in like this, it would move forward. It does. This is at rest and it's coming in.
Here's mass 2.
Yeah.
Here's mass 1. Let's do this according to my board, right? So mass 1 comes in here, this flies off, this bounces.
All right.
So it does make sense, right? This is a bigger mass. So the only thing is that's different than what you did in the lab, for example, right? You had big mass going into a little one. This is a little one going into a big one. The little one hits the big one, goes back, and the big one takes off. You have that picture? So now it makes sense. All right, let's do another type of a problem. Example. Here's a typical problem that always comes up called the ballistic pendulum. Okay. In the case of the ballistic pendulum, this does involve a collision. But it also involves conservation of energy in a different way. This is not an elastic collision. This is an inelastic collision. Okay, as we will see. So this is just another type of collision. And the idea is the following. Again, I need a before picture. In And the idea is this. For a ballistic pendulum, what you have is a block of wood, and you fire a bullet into the block of wood. The bullet is going pretty fast, all right, and it's kind of hard to measure how fast that's going. So one way to measure how fast it's going is to find out, basically, by how much the block plus the bullet move after the block, the bullet penetrates the block. So that's the basic idea. Okay, but this is a pendulum. The block is not just sitting there. If I shot up a gun, right, bullet goes into a block of wood on the floor, right, the block of wood is going to take off. So I've got to come up with some way to measure it. So the idea is the following. You have some support. You have a few long wires. Connecting our block of wood. Then we have a bullet. That bullet is moving with some unknown velocity. Let me write little v for its velocity. This block is sitting still. And I'm going to do what? Say this bullet is 10 grams. And let's say the block is 2.5 kilograms. We'll call the mass of the block big M. We'll call the mass of the bullet little m. So the mass of the bullet, actually, is 10 grams. Again, it's coming into this block of wood. We don't know how fast it's going. We want to know how fast it's going. It embeds itself in this block of wood. So there is a collision. All right? So right after this, there's a collision. So this is after just for a moment. And afterwards, there's a big M. And there's a little M embedded in the big M. These guys, this block plus the mass of the bullet begin to move at some velocity, which I'll designate as capital V. Or this is directly after the collision. So this system is connected to some strings. What's going to happen when that system of big M plus little m are moving together? It's going to swing. So after, right after the collision, they begin to move, and then it swings up. So the point here is that at some time, this swings up. Let's say it swings up here. And it moves up. Now let's say it moves up some height, h. The faster the bullet embeds it, right, is moving, when it embeds in here, this system is probably going to be moving faster, which means it's going to go higher. All right? Let's say, let's say that the height, say it goes up, is 65 centimeters or 0.65 meters. Quite a bit. Maybe these are really long strings. So this is going to swing up. Okay. Let's see. Given this information, the question is, how fast is the bullet moving? Okay. So there's the idea of the ballistic pendulum. Let me do that again. We have a bullet. You fire it. The bullet hits this block of wood. That's a collision. Right afterwards, it swings up. You measure that it's gone up 0.65 meters. From this information, determine how fast the bullet is moving. Okay? So there are two parts to this problem. Part one is the collision. The bullet embeds in the block. Part two will be pendulum motion. Swing up. What kind of collision is it? Is it elastic or inelastic? Inelastic. Why? They stick together. We do not expect the energy, the mechanical energy, to be conserved. Okay. But assuming that just at this instant, before it starts to swing, this is one-dimensional, right? Gravity's not playing a role yet. So there's no net external force acting on the system. Conservation of linear momentum tells me the total momentum before is equal to total momentum afterwards. So let's write this down. Total momentum initially is equal to the total momentum after. So before the collision, what's the momentum? What's the momentum of the block before the collision?
Zero.
What's the momentum of the bullet before the collision? Mv. Little m, little v. Little m, little v. Okay, the instant after the collision, what is the total momentum? It's the total mass, little m plus big m, is moving at a velocity of big V. Or I could take little m times big V and big M times big V and add them together. As I indicated before, that's equivalent, right? Okay, so the total momentum before is equal to total momentum after. What do I know? I know the masses. I don't know either of the velocities, do I? So I've got one equation, two unknowns, which of course tells me I need more information. Where do I get the information from? I'll get it from this part of the experiment. So part two, you make use of the pendulum. Okay, so this is a slightly different part from what we've been talking about the last 2 days. How would I figure out the height to anything that we've written down? What would that relate to? Say what? Potential energy. Okay, there, the masses together are going to go up. There's a change in height. So someone said, there's a change in potential energy. Okay. What happens when it reaches some maximum height? What's zero? Velocity is zero. So if the velocity is zero, what else is zero? In terms of that, it's related to the potential kinetic energy. So, if there's no frictional losses in this swing, right? Just conservative forces, then we would expect energy conservation now. That's not energy conservation for the collision. That's after the collision. Now that this block system has velocity V, it swings up. It's got maximum kinetic energy at the bottom. That kinetic energy goes to zero as it swings up, becomes potential energy. So we have that initially, at the bottom of the swing, we have 1/2 the mass times the square of the velocity. The mass is the total mass of the times the square of the velocity, which the velocity of this block plus bullet is capital V. That's the kinetic energy it has at the bottom of the swing. That must be equal to mgh when it reaches the top of the swing. Okay? Everybody clear on that? So this is moving at until it comes up, it slows down, comes to a stop, course, what's going to happen is going to start swinging. But I don't care as long as I know how high it got. I know H. If I know H, I can get big V. If I know big V, now I can plug that in here and get little V. Right? So we can finish the problem. We can plug numbers in to finish the problem. Or I could do it algebraically. Let me do it algebraically. Okay, so for capital V in terms of the masses in little h. So solving that, I get what? Multiply both sides by 2. Oh, did I put the wrong number? Obviously, this is capital, the total mass G8. They both go up. Okay, so solve for big V. That makes life a little easier, too. All right, so when the masses go out, you probably could have guessed that. All right, and we get what? 2GH. Take the square root. So I know what big V is. And in the first equation, we have little mv is equal to the sum of the masses times big V, which is m plus little m square root of 2gh. Is that right? Now I can divide by little m. Now I know how fast the bullets travel. Now let's plug some numbers in. What's the big mass? This is 2.5 kilograms plus 0.01 kilograms divided by 0.01. Since M is much smaller than big M, I could have canceled this, right? Could have just left it as big M. That's a big difference. Times square root of 2 times 9.8 times 0.65. And so this is at least 25. Right. We have a number for me.
Is that M plus big M plus little M over little M?
Yes, it is. Because over here I have little M divided through, so it's little M plus big M over little M. Okay. We get a number?
8.9.
What?
8.9.
8.9.
896.
896. Or probably about 900 meters per second. Pretty pessimistic. Is that fast? So that's pretty good. All right, so there's an example where you need to think about the process that's going on in different steps. All right, we first have a collision, and you've got to separate that in your mind, even though it takes place like that, that collision, you've got to separate that from the motion that happens after. So here it comes in, it collides, we have no energy conservation, but then it begins to swing up, and now we have conservation of energy for that half of the process. So we can dream up all sorts of other types of problems like that. All right, let's take a break. Chapter. So in this chapter we saw what can happen when we have a system of masses, different kinds of masses all clumped together, and these systems could be moving, could collide with each other, forces could act on our system, etc. And in some cases it may be useful to say something about the average position of each mass in the system as it's moving around. So let's take an example. Let's say I have a plate. A circular plate like this, and you let go of it, and it drops and it smashes. Alright? And the pieces fly off. Alright? So, beforehand, I've got a plate that, at least with respect to horizontal, is not moving this direction. Right? Maybe dropping, but that's the vertical direction. I'm just looking at the horizontal direction. Once the plate hits the ground, right, pieces fly off in different directions. If there is no net external force acting in the horizontal direction, then we know that the total momentum here will be equal to the total momentum there. And if somehow I could describe the average position of each piece, we would say that the average position of all these pieces at all times would be the same as this. Right? So if this were directly over the origin, for example, then I could take and say that each of these pieces somehow, on average, is about a certain distance from the origin. So we can talk about its behavior. Or perhaps one throws this plate up in the air and some little explosive device is connected to it in some way to make it blow up. Alright? Or you can think of other things that could possibly explode as they're flying through the air. In that particular case, that center, that average position of all objects is not going to stay constant, but instead it's going to follow the same path a projectile would follow. So if I throw some object up in the air, and maybe it's made up of a couple of things, and they come flying apart, like firecrackers, whatever, right? And all the pieces fly off. If you found that average position for your system at all times, you would find that that average follows projectile motion. Okay. So this average position of a system is what we will refer to as the center of mass. Now, it's a little more complicated in several dimensions, as you can imagine. So we're going to define what the center of mass is for simpler systems. We'll start off with 1D. But once I know how to get the average position in X, you can do the same thing in Y and Z. Write down a general formula for all coordinates. So let's consider the one-dimensional situation. And let's consider two masses. Here's mass one. There's mass two. I would like to say something about the average position or the center of mass of this system. This position depends, of course, on your coordinate system. So I need to locate the origin. So since this is one-dimensional, mass one and mass two are on the x-axis. Let's say the origin is located there. That corresponds to x equals zero. And then from x equals zero, I can measure where mass one is. Mass one has position x1. Mass two has position x2, right? So this is x equals zero. Mass one could be at 10 centimeters. Mass two could be at 30 centimeters. And then the question is, what is the average? Another way to think about this is to take a rod like this meter stick. Let's assume the meter stick has no mass for right now. I could put one mass here. Whoa. Heavy. All right, and I could take another mass and put it over there, and then I could ask, where's the center? Well, the center would be probably near the heavy mass, right? Because that one has more effect. It's a weighted average. So what I could do is actually find out where the stick balances. The only problem is this stick is not massless. I should take into account the stick. But we'll learn about that in the lab today. Right. So we could imagine having a massless rod and asking, where could I put my fingers to balance this? You would expect over here would not be very good. Over there wouldn't be good. You would put it over here and you would be closer to the bigger mass. Somewhere in between these two masses, not necessarily exactly in between, okay, is the position of the center of mass. And what this is a weighted average. It's very similar to test grades and quizzes. You have an exam and a quiz, right? You don't just take the average of an exam and plus the quiz, right? You don't add the exam to the quiz and divide by two, do you? Usually the exams weigh more. They count more. The same type of thing goes here. Alright, so you get a weighted average. We will define the center of mass to be the following. We take the position of mass 1 and multiply it by its weight, which is mass 1. So we'll write m1x1. And then we take mass 2 and multiply it by its position x2. Alright, so that means that if mass 1 is bigger, this term is going to get more importance. Of course, I can't stop there because it's kilograms times meters, right? And I don't want kilograms times meters coming out. I want meters coming out. So I have to divide by something, as you might have guessed from the line there. Alright, let's just divide by the total mass of the system. That's the definition of the x-coordinate of the center of mass. Just to see that this is a weighted average, what we can do is rewrite that by thinking of, alright, m1 plus m2 is a constant. I can divide this into the first term, divide it in the second term, and I could write down m1 over the total mass times x1 plus m2 over the total mass times x2. So we can see that what's multiplying the positions are the fraction of the total mass that m1 is with the fraction of the total mass that f2 is. So the bigger fraction that m1 takes, the more important this position will be. And so that will land us near that position. Okay. In general, what if I had three masses? How do you think I would fix this equation? Okay, divide by three masses. So I have one m1 plus m2 plus m3. Is that the only thing I need to do? No, I have to put out here an m3 plus times x3 and add that. So this is easily generalizable, at least for point masses, for determining where things are. And now we can ask what happens in a collision, right? Here's mass 1 and mass 2. What if they move? For example, the problem I had before, mass 2 was sitting here, mass 1 moved. You believe the center of mass moves? Yeah. Center of mass moves. Okay, so we could look at how the center of mass changes. The change in the center of mass is actually equal to m1 times the change in position 1 plus m2 times the change in position 2 divided by the total. So if the masses don't change, the only thing that could change are their positions. So one can write down the center of mass at one instant, write down it at another instant, subtract, and get a result that looks like that. If I divide these by the amount of time it takes to observe the changes in positions of these, then I get delta XCM over delta T is equal to M1 delta, let's see, delta X1 delta T plus M2 delta X2 over delta T, all divided by, isn't that ugly? If I divide by the amount of time it takes for the mass to change, right? If mass 1 changes position, mass 2 changes position in some period of time, then the center of mass changes in that time, so I could divide delta t into here, divide delta t into both of these. What is position over velocity? So we find out that m1v1 plus m2v2, right? Delta x1 over delta t is a change in position of mass 1 per time. That's just its velocity. Delta x2 over delta xt is the change in position per time for the second mass. That's its velocity. What is m1v1 plus m2v2? What is m1v1? Momentum. What's m2v2? Momentum. This is the total momentum of the system. Divided by the total mass of the system is equal to the change in the position of the center of mass per time. Well, this is another position per time, so that's a velocity. What do you think that's the velocity of? The center of mass. So we can see that the velocity of the center of mass is nothing other than the total momentum of the system divided by the total mass. Actually, if I bring this over, we find out that this is just another statement of a conservation of momentum for this system of particles. So there is a connection between computing the center of mass for systems of particles and the momentum of my system. The momentum of my system is related to the velocity of the center of mass of the system. But that's about all we're going to do right now with that. What we are about to embark upon in the next two chapters is going to be slightly different in one way, but again, it's going to be a summary of what we've been doing up until now. All right, I'm not quite done. We really need to pay attention to thinking about what we've been doing the last 2 weeks, because we're going to learn how your calculators, which some of you already learned how to switch to degrees, but we're going to be going back and forth between degrees and radians. So we're going to define radians and start working with angular vectors. So be ready. Okay, see you in the lab.